This is a summary of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone by bestbookbriefings.com. Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed by Flory Gottlieb. It's hard to be human. Compared to the universe we live in, we're very small, almost insignificant. But how we experience life, how we feel too much, and how we embrace the world is nothing less than spectacular. This summary of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone is about being human. It's about our pain, our happiness, and our feelings. It's also about how we relate to each other, how healing happens, and how we change. The purpose of this summary is to reveal our shared humanity so we can see ourselves and each other through fresh eyes. Who knows, maybe a shift in perception is all we need to change the world. Maybe You Should Talk to Someone is the unique memoir of clinical psychotherapist Flory Gottlieb. This summary follows the stories of five of Flory's patients, as well as her personal story with therapy. John's story, Where Compassion Can Take You. Have compassion, have compassion, Flory told herself as she listened to her new patient, John. Flory's job taught her to give people a chance to look for something good or even likable in every person. But that was a little difficult with John. It was only his second session, and he had already insulted Flory and compared her to a hooker. John complained that he was surrounded by idiots. His wife, his children, his former therapist, his crew at work, they were all too demanding. At first, Flory struggled to see the good in John who wouldn't. But as she listened to him rant, she noticed some kind of familiarity, not in his words but in the feelings behind them. Sometimes, it's easier to blame the outside world for our inner struggles and frustration. It's one way to affirm ourselves, to cover up an otherwise unbearable pain. That's what John did by looking at everyone else as if they were idiots. Flory knew how that felt like. You see, she too was going through a painful experience at the time. Just one day before, her boyfriend had suddenly broken up with her, although the two were planning on getting married. Flory realized that her seemingly rude patient, John, was just a human in pain. As a therapist, she understood that pain follows loss, and that loss was the natural result of change, any type of change, no matter big or small. Flory's job was to discover John's loss so she could help him heal his pain. It's a misconception that therapists should totally abandon their own feelings and personal vulnerabilities during their sessions with patients. In fact, it's being human that gives a therapist their credibility, even more than their certifications. While therapists cannot show their humanity in their sessions, they can burst into tears or talk about their own lives. Being human helps them understand and relate to their patients' struggles. Over the sessions, Flory got to know John. She learned that he was a 40-year-old married man with two daughters and a dog. He worked as a writer and producer of popular TV shows. He had even won an Emmy before. John's mother died when he was 6 years old, of course, that contributed to his defensiveness, but he refused to talk about her in depth. People like John, people who are demanding, critical, and angry tend to suffer from intense loneliness. They struggle to be vulnerable, because to them, vulnerability is equal to shame. It's easier for them to dismiss their emotions than to experience them. John, for example, was a very good husband. He loved his wife dearly. He was loyal to her. He provided for his family. But he failed to express his own needs. At home, he often felt misunderstood and unheard. And whenever his wife tried to approach him, to get closer to him, he'd push her away. In the middle of one session, John accidentally mentioned the name Gabe. When Flory asked him who Gabe was, she was met by resistance. Flory had learned that resistance is a good sign. Follow the resistance, and you'll get to the core issue, she had been taught. Thus, she insisted on her question and pushed John to answer it. Eventually, John exploded, saying that Gabe was his son. It took John a while to open up about Gabe, his young child who died in a car accident when he was only 6. After Gabe's death, John and his wife blamed each other for a while. And even though they apologized later, they never seemed to move on from the blame. They couldn't stop imagining different scenarios in which Gabe was saved. What if we had done this or that? What if we hadn't done this or that? We might have been able to prevent the accident. John had been keeping all these feelings in, all the sadness, all the anger. At his worst moments, when he was about to break down, he reminded himself of being a parent. He couldn't allow himself to crumble and to take it out on his daughters in one way or another. He believed he had already failed his son, and so he didn't want to fail his daughters. Lori explained to John that part of being a dad is being human. There can always be a safe space for a parent to explore his full range of emotions. They could choose to do that on their own, but they could also choose to share their feelings with their partners or their therapists. Lori also realized that the persona John had created for himself was only a defense mechanism. As long as he felt special, and as long as he believed he was surrounded with idiots, he was strong enough to survive the loss of his son. By time, John learned to lower his defenses. He became more willing to share with his wife and to talk about his feelings and his needs. And to Lori, that was success. Rita's story, opening up to life. When Rita first came to Lori's office, she declared a plan. Unless her life improved over the following year, she was planning to end it. "I think I'm beyond help," she said, "but I want to give it one last try, just to be certain." Suicidal thoughts are common among patients with depression. Most of the time, people who are thinking of suicide don't want to end their life, they just want to get rid of their pain. So whenever the topic of suicide comes up, the therapist has to evaluate the situation and to see if the patient is in actual danger. In Rita's case, Lori didn't have to worry about suicide. She understood that what Rita really wanted was to change. On the other hand, Lori was worried that she had nothing to offer Rita. After all, Rita was a 70-year-old, divorced woman with many regrets. She chose the wrong husbands, messed up her relationship with her kids, wasted her years without building a career. The list goes on. Rita spent her days on her own, doing some aerobics, watching TV, painting and napping. And even those things were no longer interesting to her. She had no job, no family, no friends, and no pets. In other words, she had no reason to get up in the morning. As people age, they begin to struggle with many issues: retirement, illness, loss of loved ones, etc. Yet older people are usually less aware of the importance of mental health. At the same time, many therapists find it challenging to deal with seniors. A 70-year-old like Rita may still have decades left in her life, but without the proper mental health care, she might have to spend these decades suffering. Luckily for Rita, she was one of a few seniors that reached out for help. Her sessions with Lori helped her alleviate the feeling of loneliness. After a while, Rita's life began to improve. She befriended the neighbors and she started to teach their kids how to paint. She started a website to sell her art, and the man she loved confessed his feelings for her. With all these amazing changes, Lori expected Rita to be happier, but Rita couldn't allow herself to feel better. To Rita, feeling bad was a form of self-punishment. She believed that she deserved misery for all the crimes she did. She was a bad mother, and she didn't deserve forgiveness. Feeling bad was also a form of protection. As long as she kept herself hidden in her pain, Rita didn't have to face life and to risk getting hurt again. Through therapy, Rita learned to open herself to the world. She took a risk and wrote a letter to the man she loved, telling him about her past. She opened up about her secrets and her biggest regrets. She thought he would reject her and punish her in the same way she used to punish herself, but he respected her vulnerability and accepted her as she was. He understood that every person comes with wounds that only love can heal, and he offered her that kind of love. Charlotte's story, how people change. The 25-year-old Charlotte was an alcoholic. While she claimed that she only drank a few glasses of wine a day, Lori knew the real number was at least the double of that. Charlotte refused to confront her alcoholism. However, she had no problem admitting her other addiction, therapy. Charlotte was addicted to Lori. She loved being in her office, and she was always disappointed when the session was over. Charlotte never had a good relationship with her parents. Ever since she was a kid, she had to parent herself as well as take care of her younger brother. As an adult, Charlotte struggled with her love life. She could only be attracted to unavailable men. Usually, people are attracted to what's familiar. If someone is born and raised with parents who are always angry, they are more likely to get attracted to angry people. And if someone is born and raised with distant parents, like Charlotte, they're more likely to get attracted to distant people. These people don't mean to hurt themselves by choosing toxic partners. They don't even realize what they're doing. But unconsciously, they choose what's familiar. Even if it hurts, at least it hurts in a familiar way. To Charlotte, emotional stability felt foreign. She equated love, not with comfort and peace, but with anxiety. This is why she loved therapy so much. It offered her the connection and the sense of intimacy she longed for, but at the same time, it offered her distance. After the session was over, Charlotte was free to distance herself and to avoid unnecessary intimacy. According to the Trans-Theoretical Model of Behavior Change, TTM, people change through five sequential stages: pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and maintenance. Charlotte's journey with therapy offers a perfect example of this model. 1. Pre-contemplation. This was the stage when Charlotte denied her alcohol problem. She presented herself to Lori as only a social drinker, and she refused to think of herself as anything else. 2. Contemplation. One day, Charlotte was driving drunk, and she had a car accident. That accident opened Charlotte's eyes to her problem and moved her into the contemplation stage. This stage is often when people choose to see a therapist and to talk about their problems. 3. Preparation. In stage 3, Charlotte had to emotionally prepare herself to change by giving up a subconscious bargain she had made. In Charlotte's mind, she had told herself that she wouldn't change her own bad behaviors unless her parents changed. That was a lose-lose deal, since she could never force her parents to change. For action, it took Charlotte 2 months to finally move into the fourth stage and to ask Lori to recommend an addiction treatment program, to which she committed. 5. Maintenance. Charlotte entered the final stage after she had maintained sobriety for a significant period of time. Then, she started to see the improvements in all areas of her life. Her memory got better and she was able to concentrate more. She enrolled in graduate school and did some charity work. She got rid of her toxic friends and she started to open up more in therapy. Of course, during the maintenance phase, relapse is expected. Stress and other factors can force a person to go back to unwanted behaviors. That happened with Charlotte too, but using the proper coping mechanisms, she was able to move on. Charlotte's love life followed the similar stages of change. When Charlotte realized her own dating patterns, she became more able to make the right decisions and to leave any relationships that no longer served her. Julie's story: facing the inevitable. Julie was a recently married, 30-year-old college professor who was diagnosed with terminal cancer. There was no escape from Julie's situation. All she could do was to adapt to the news and to live despite her fear of death. Through therapy sessions with Lori, Julie learned to fully live what's left of her life and to take risks that she would have never taken. Julie quit her academic job to become a cashier at a grocery store. At first, her husband objected. He didn't understand why Julie would want to spend her last year working anyway. But Julie explained that working as a cashier was what she really wanted to do. Lori believed that the cashier job represented an escape, a fantasy that Julie's pre-cancer self longed for. Unconsciously, Julie craved the daily interaction with customers that could give her a sense of freedom. She chose that freedom even though the job was physically tiring. But by time, the cancer got the most out of Julie. She had to choose between organs to forsake. We all have to face difficult decisions on a daily basis, but Julie's choices were unbearable. To either die or to get your colon removed. To either die or to get your uterus removed. She wondered how much had to be taken from her before she was no longer herself. Despite that, she kept her disease a secret from people at work. She wanted them to know her for being Julie, not for being a cancer patient. While working with Lori, Julie also explored her feelings toward her husband, Matt. Ever since they learned about the cancer, Matt had been very supportive of Julie. But he was human, and the experience was difficult for him as well. Julie loved and appreciated her husband so much, but she also envied him. At least he had a chance of getting his life back after Julie's death. At least he still had his health. It was normal to feel that way. Even lovers can sometimes envy one another. But Julie also felt like a burden that Matt had to carry. She wondered if he was waiting for her to die. After all, he wouldn't be able to move on until her death. Through therapy, Julie explored all these contradicting feelings, and she decided to spend what was left of her life helping Matt move on. Together, Matt and Julie prepared for Julie's funeral, in the same way they once planned their wedding. Julie wanted her funeral to be a celebration of life. While she had no future, she could make peace with her past and present. Becca's story. When nothing seems to work. Becca was a 30-year-old woman who came to Lori 1 year earlier, complaining about her social life. She said that her co-workers excluded her, and that whenever she started to date somebody, they'd break up with her after only 2 months. According to Becca, her boyfriends were all commitment phobes, and her co-workers snobby. What irritated Lori the most was that Becca had no curiosity about herself. She didn't see her own problems or try to understand them, so it was hard for Lori to help her. Whenever Lori tried to explore the reasons why people excluded Becca, Becca would feel accused and criticized. More than that, she'd feel disappointed at Lori. How come she couldn't understand her? What Becca didn't know was that the way she reacted to Lori was the same way she reacted to the other people in her life. That's what happens in therapy. Patients project their own relationship patterns onto their therapists. For Lori, a patient like Becca was much more challenging than other patients. Becca kept coming to sessions without trying to change anything about herself. Lori even felt bored during the sessions. She could barely keep herself awake. During a consultation meeting with a group of therapists, Lori explained that she had tried everything she could with Becca, but nothing seemed to work. When one of Lori's colleagues asks why Lori hadn't stopped seeing Becca, Lori said that she didn't want Becca to feel stranded. She already feels emotionally stranded, Lori's colleague said, by everyone in her life, including you. Therapy is difficult for both the therapist and the patient. While the therapist has to do their job and to try several techniques to get into the patient's head, it's the patient's responsibility to actually change. Unless the patient is progressing, the therapist is supposed to stop seeing them. Otherwise, it's considered negligence. So eventually, Lori decided to listen to her colleague's advice and she canceled her sessions with Becca. Therapy can't help someone who doesn't want to be helped. Lori's story, in search for meaning. Therapists are people too. No matter what certifications they hold, they are humans that get problems and insecurities, and even mental disorders, and that doesn't make them any less good at their job. Lori's personal story with therapy started when her boyfriend decided to break up with her. He explained that he loved her and he wanted to marry her, but she was a single mother and he didn't want to live with a kid. Lori didn't take the breakup so well. It was sudden and unexpected. She didn't know how to handle it, so she decided to see a therapist. It's mandatory for therapists to receive therapy for a certain amount of hours before they get their license, so it wasn't Lori's first time to be a patient, although it was the most intense. Lori's therapist was called Wendell Bronson. At their first session, Lori kept talking about the breakup. She explained what happened and how it made her feel. She obsessed over her boyfriend and how bad he was for leaving her and her kid heartbroken. But Wendell knew that Lori's problem went beyond the breakup. In fact, the breakup was only the presenting problem. A presenting problem is the issue that brings a person to therapy. For Lori, it was her breakup. For someone else, it could be a job loss, a panic attack, a relationship problem, or, basically, anything. But a presenting problem is only the top layer hiding the person's real problems underneath. And it's the therapist's job to help the patient move beyond the first layer and identify the real cause of their pain. Despite being a therapist herself, when Lori went to therapy, she did exactly what she advised her patients against. She lied to herself so she could look better. No matter how Wendell tried to get to her, she kept talking about her boyfriend and how he hurt her. She stalked him on social media and obsessed over what he did, and she continued to live in the memory of the breakup. For therapy to work, the therapist has to see the patient for who they are. But as much as patients want to heal, they also want to be liked, so they would say anything to hide up their vulnerability. Thus, a therapist has to give their patient a safe space where they can express themselves without the fear of being judged. They can do this by using the right words, or by displaying small gestures, like offering the patient a tissue when they start to cry. When Wendell saw Lori like this, he rose up from his seat, approached her, and lightly kicked her on the foot with his leg. "You seem like you're enjoying the experience of suffering, so I thought I'd help you out with that," he said. He explained that pain and suffering are not the same thing. Everyone experiences pain. It's inevitable, but by staying fixated on her boyfriend, Lori was choosing to suffer. Why would anyone choose to suffer? Because suffering serves an unconscious purpose for them. Lori wondered what that purpose was for her. Earlier, Wendell had mentioned that throughout Lori's relationship with her boyfriend, she had ignored many clues that showed he didn't want children. He was easily irritated by kids in public places, he didn't enjoy spending time with her kid, and so on. But Lori had pretended away all these things because she didn't want to face the truth. One day, as Lori vented to Wendell, she said something that grabbed his attention. She said that half of her life was already over. Wendell waited for the right moment to bring these words up, and to discuss with Lori the real fear underlying her obsession with her boyfriend, her fear of death. A while before the breakup, Lori had begun experiencing some strange symptoms that her doctors failed to diagnose. She started to contemplate death, and to think of herself as too old, although she was only in her 40s. The fear of death was too much for Lori to handle, so she had to hide it away to cover it as if with a curtain or a comfort blanket. Lori's boyfriend was that blanket. The vision of her future with him took her attention away from her fear. That was why she found it hard to let go. Unless she clung to that blanket, she'd have to face her hidden fears all by herself. Just like physical therapy, psychotherapy is tough. It hurts as it sheds the light on feelings and wounds that we'd rather keep buried. But in the long term, therapy can heal these wounds. At first, it can make us feel worse, but then it makes us feel better. Another topic that Lori opened up in her sessions with Wendell was her book. During the time Lori cried over her boyfriend and stalked him on social media, she was supposed to be writing a book about parenting. She had already made a deal with a publisher, and she had received and spent the initial payment. So unless she actually produced the book, there would be consequences. But after Lori agreed to write the book, she realized that she didn't like the topic. Thus, she was torn between two choices, to either write the book and provide for her family, or to pass on the deal and find something meaningful to do. These two choices created a conflict that Lori failed to settle, and Lori used her boyfriend drama to distract herself from this conflict as well. Throughout her therapy sessions, Lori learned that her problem was more than her breakup. She was fighting a battle, not against death, failure, or loneliness, but against living a meaningless life. Often, people mistake happiness for meaning. They spend their life trying to be happy, but they don't understand that happiness is just a temporary state. It's neither perfect nor permanent. Meaning, on the other hand, can give a value to one's life, despite the problems and the imperfections. Thus, Lori's journey with therapy was a search for meaning. She quit writing the book she didn't want, returned the payment, and then gave herself time to find something she wanted to do, something she believed in. And this was how she came up with the idea of her book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. In writing her book, Lori found meaning that helped her overcome the difficulties in her life. Parting words. It's funny how people are so different, but so alike. We tell ourselves we're alone, while we're surrounded by people who share our same dreams, hopes, needs, fears, and worries. While Lori helped her own patients, she realized she could see herself in them. She saw herself in John's defensiveness, in Rita's fear of life, in Charlotte's avoidance, in Julie's willingness to live, and even in Becca's resistance. It's the therapist's job to hold a mirror to their patients, to help them understand themselves and process their deepest feelings. And in return, patients become a mirror to their therapists. When a patient asks a question, the therapist has to think about it and to reflect back to their own lives. Thus, healing is a parallel process. It's never one-sided. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.